This is a Fred-friendly seminar, Minds on the Edge. We're talking about serious mental illness in America. Patients, healthcare providers, community organizers, judges, lawyers, and legislators, all struggling with the boundaries of personal freedom, protection, and the law. Our moderator and broadcast journalist, Frank Sesno, now addresses psychiatrist Tracy Scale, journalist Pete Early, and attorney Susan Steffen.
So let's return to our world. James agrees to come in for treatment, and you will provide that. James is now at Commonwealth Psychiatric Hospital, and so is Olivia. Olivia's parents, despite what happened in the hospital there, did manage to get her to come home, and you spent months dealing with the trauma, the emotion. You provided everything that a loving, able family could provide, and you also came up with a diagnosis: bipolar disorder with psychotic features. What's that? Dr. Scale.
A person with bipolar disorder will experience changes in mood. They might be manic, like we saw Olivia earlier, with high energy states, no need to sleep. They just really don't need to sleep. Pressured speech, they're easily distractible. Or they might have periods of extreme despair. Inter-episodically, they're neither manic nor depressed. A very tricky time to get people to see that they have illness during that time because they feel fine.
Mom and Dad, you wake up one morning and she's gone. So you go out looking for her again. This has become familiar, unfortunately, to you. And you find her sometime later on a street corner. Her blouse is ripped. She's got a black eye. And you fear maybe she's been sexually abused. She's haranguing passersby. She's telling them that they have to listen to me. Listen to me. You're here again. Pete Early.
Yep, you're right back in the same spot. By this time, you've counted pills, threatened to throw them out if they don't take pills. You realize you can't talk to them about pills because they know absolutely how you stand on pills. But hopefully you're smart enough to know now how to try to navigate through this system.
Okay.
Good luck.
And you have talked about this before, but now you decide that civil commitment is what is going to be required. What is civil commitment?
Depends on the state, but you have the person held against their will, involuntarily committed for up to 72 hours, and a hearing is held. The person who is facing involuntary commitment, by law, has an attorney there. That attorney does not represent you. It represents the person who is ill.
Susan Steffen, you're staff attorney at the Center for Public Representation, and you are going to represent Olivia.
Well, Olivia is lucky because I care a lot about Olivia, and I'm going to show up ahead of time. I'm going to talk to Olivia ahead of time. I'm going to look at her records ahead of time, and that makes me one in a thousand, because the thought that Olivia is represented is an illusion. Somebody's going to show up at the hearing and say, "I'm your lawyer." That person is more likely than not going to collude in Olivia's commitment.
Well, you're better than that.
I am better.
You're
than
better
that.
Than that. And Olivia is going to tell you that she doesn't want to be put away in a hospital.
Which is a rational desire, given the effects on your life of a history of civil commitment.
You're about to represent.
You're
about
to
represent Olivia at this hearing. You've now
Kathy,
heard from.
You seem like a wonderful person. Can I talk to you, please? It's my parents. They think they're in the same spot. It's not the spot. It's the spa. Three letters, spa. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. We're tying it all together. The philosophy, the religion, and the law.
Do you have a place to
live? Are you listening?
Yes, I am. And I'm trying to help you get out of the hospital. Are you willing to go home and live with your parents? Because the judge is going to want to know that you have a place to go.
Susan and Olivia, can we take a break here for a minute? As her attorney, what's your role?
My job is to represent what she wants. Right. But my job is also to counsel her.
Okay, but to represent what she wants, let's stay with that. She does not want to go to this facility that her parents want to commit her to.
Yeah.
So your position in front of the bench and the state of Commonwealth will be what?
That she should be discharged. My position is also to counsel her so that, for instance, I would say to her, look, you may want to go to the spa, but if you want to get out of here, put a lid on the spa thing for a little while because it's not going to help you get out. If you want to get out, let's talk about practically how we're going to accomplish that.
And you're trying to help Olivia maintain, preserve her autonomy, correct?
That's what she's my client,
okay.
And I'm supposed to represent her.
You run into her parents in the hall.
I want to keep Olivia safe, and I know you're working toward a discharge, but a discharge to what?
That's very important. We all want to keep Olivia safe. I've been appointed to represent your daughter. I know you've been going through hell. I'm trying to find out, what have you tapped into in the community? What are you aware of in terms of what can help you keep Olivia at home? Because that's where I want Olivia to go back.
God bless you, because you care enough not to just get her out. But here's what I want to know from you. When this hearing's over and you get Olivia out and she's standing in that hallway with us, will you help us get her into those services?
Absolutely.
Will you make the phone calls? Because we have tried and failed.
Absolutely, because that's what I do. My brand of lawyering isn't walk in and walk out. I think that what the parents want is for Olivia to be safe long-term, to do well, to have a job,
that's right,
to thrive.
And how is getting her out of the system going to help that when we're trying to get her in the system? How are you fit to judge whether my daughter needs to be in a hospital or not? And why does the court say she has to be dangerous first? She is sick. She needs help. Why is the law stopping me from getting her help?
Justice Breyer, take us into some of what we're hearing here, which is two very different versions and visions of autonomy for Olivia.
I think that's the problem here. When we had a rule that made it too easy to put people in institutions, they were warehoused and forgotten. And sometimes, at least, those institutions were pretty bad. And on the other hand, when you have a law that makes it too hard to put people into institutions, you get into the tragic situations we've just seen. And so this standard, I think, dangerous to yourself or others, immediately I heard a very interesting question. And you said imminent. Is it imminent or is it not imminent?
It's changing, but that's a Supreme Court standard. No, it's a Supreme Court standard in Connor versus whatever. I'm not a lawyer.
For different, maybe there's some room in the standard, and if you don't like that standard, the difficulty from the point of view of a lawyer or a judge is what is the standard then? Not whether that's perfect, but what is a better one?
Judge Stephen Lifeman.
And then there's two serious problems here. The first is, if they're lucky and they get the daughter hospitalized, she's going to get great care now. But she's going to get out in 3 months. And she's going to go right back into the same horrible system that let her go into that. And the second, this is the other issue that I think we need to change our thinking on. For a lot of people, when they're in crisis, it's like having a heart attack of the brain. We don't bring a heart attack victim to court and spend 2 weeks and decide if they should get treatment. We now know, though, that the longer
it
takes to get someone treatment for a mental health crisis, the more likelihood of permanent brain damage.
You don't lock up heart attack victims either. And the reason that there's a lawyer is because it's a legal process, because you actually, private citizens, can't lock people up. Right. And so there must be legal representation.
I think autonomy is extremely important, and it's good for patients to have a right to refuse, not because it's good for them to refuse treatment, but because it's good for them to have choice. And I think in addition to combating stigma and providing resources so people can get treatment, one of the things we should do, instead of using a lot of force, is study how we could use less force, how we can bring it about so that people want treatment and don't have to have force.
Anytime you lock up someone against their will, you're going to almost always have a negative experience with that. You want people, if they need to be in a hospital, want to be there.
This hearing takes place before you. How will you make your decision?
Well, we'll listen to the facts of the case. I'll see if there's any evidence that it's imminent dangerousness to self or others. And imminent is usually the hardest hurdle. And based upon what I heard, she's probably not in imminent danger, and it would be very difficult for me to involuntarily hospitalize her.
Judge Stephen Lifeman, one of Florida's leading advocates for mental health reform, makes his ruling. So what is to become of our invented patients, Olivia and James? Will they find help from our many experts? This is a Fred-friendly seminar on mental health in America, Minds on the Edge. I'm Cokie Roberts. The system seems so flawed, yet some of our panelists who are on the front lines are encouraged by recent advancements. Psychologist Fred Fries.
But now at least we know that it is the brain and there is a biological problem.
Whereas a generation ago, when I first came down with this, it was Sigmund Freud, your mother's problem. There was no understanding that there was any connection with the brain at all. So we've made tremendous progress.
Former Oregon State Senator Ava Gordley worked in the legislature to improve mental health care, just as she fought to get treatment for her own son. She challenges families.
Raise as much hell as possible, as loudly as possible, in getting care, in getting the care that you know your child needs, and risk everything to get that help, to get that care.
There's such compelling evidence that if you don't work with people, that any number of bad things can happen.
Psychiatrist Tom Simpatico.
Yet it seems so difficult to light a fire under the general public in a way that can really mobilize a way of thinking about this problem that really changes public policy and laws to support what we know works.
Now that we do know what works, communities still face the task of implementing new solutions in the face of politics, prejudice, and economic pressures. Several years ago, a mentally ill man pushed Kendra Webdale in front of a speeding train. Her death caused the New York State Legislature to pass Kendra's Law, allowing courts to order patients to undergo treatment or take medication. Is this the answer? Frank Sesno addresses the panel, beginning with University of Pennsylvania bioethicist Art Kaplan.
Let's come back to James. He's back out on the streets, and the voices are back. And they say that he should die, and he feels threatened. He's at a street festival, surrounded by people. And the voices are closing in. He reaches for a glass bottle to defend himself and breaks that bottle. And sadly, tragically, a shard of glass goes flying and cuts a little girl badly in the cheek. And it blinds her in one eye. Mr. Mayor, how is the media going to play this? And how is the public going to react?
Well, after I visit the little girl, I think that the public is all over my case about getting these people off the street. How I do it, where I put them, they don't much care.
What do you expect the media to be playing?
Oh, I think we're going to see pictures of the little girl and a lot of interviews with the parents, and the parents are going to be saying, what was that guy doing out? That man is a danger.
First thing we hear from is the father. What are these, quote, insane people doing out on the streets? Look what they've done to my little girl, Bethany. Avel, you're a state senator. You're scheduled to meet with somebody who is going to advocate for broader treatment laws and a change to the law.
I know that my job has just gotten more difficult in terms of working with my colleagues, many of whom don't understand mental illness, mental health issues. That job has just gotten harder.
What are you going to say to Bethany's father?
I'm going to sit with him. I'm going to listen to his plea.
Will you sponsor the bill?
I will work on behalf of the bill. He's my constituent.
Judge Leifman, what's involved in this bill? It's modeled after Kendra's Law.
Well, it's going to be an assisted outpatient bill, which means that...
No, it's called Bethany's Law.
Of course. Of course. I'm glad she's recovering. And it's going to tell the court that they're to bring people in front of them that might be exhibiting signs of serious mental illnesses, and that to tell the person if they don't stay on their medication, I'm going to order them to be temporarily hospitalized. And then I'm going to tell them once they're hospitalized and they go back to the community, if they go off their medication, they're going to come back to me. I'm going to put them back in the hospital, and it's going to put this enormous burden on the court, and we don't have any more money. And now all of a sudden I have 1,000 new cases, and I don't have a lot of answers.
Who here will testify on behalf of this bill?
I will.
Why?
Because individuals, when they are in psychosis, are disabled with regard to their ability to make a rational decision as to what's best for them.
Well, when you are
in that state of total psychosis, it is absolutely inhumane for society to ignore you and allow you to continue to be raped and abused and freezing and dying in the streets or going to jail. That's why I'll testify.
I'll testify
Dr.
as well.
Scale.
Because we see not only the imminent risk people that it's easy when someone's going to commit suicide or harm someone else. It's the other piece that I won't eat because I believe my food is poisoned. I'm out in the middle of traffic because I think I'm the traffic controller and they're putting other people at risk as well. Those are the trickier pieces.
Who's going to testify against it? Estelle Richmond.
I'm going to testify against it because locking people up doesn't produce treatment. What I need is people to invest in my community system so you get the treatment, so you have the option. If we're going to put the resources in the system, we can prevent the accident. Passing a law has nothing to do with putting in treatment.
Who else is testifying against? Sam Samberis.
I think bringing more legal involvement into a clinical matter is a mistake. The teaching moment that this example provides is to highlight how James, in fact, had been seeking treatment. We don't need more laws for him to go to treatment. He went to the emergency room. He was refused. So I would highlight the importance of having the services in place that would create a more comprehensive safety net so that these kinds of situations can be prevented.
Susan, you will testify?
Whenever something bad happens, people pass restrictive laws with no funding, and it makes people feel better. And it doesn't improve the community system. It doesn't prevent anything from happening. And frankly, I don't see any connection between, it could have been a thug who broke the bottle, and there wouldn't be people passing restrictive laws. We need community treatment. Andrew Goldstein, who was the guy for whom Kendra's law essentially was named, went to seek treatment and was turned away. We need funding for voluntary treatment.
Justice Breyer, what questions from your perspective would you have for the citizens who are testifying for or against?
As a federal judge, I'm worried about taking people's life or liberty away without what we call due process, which really means, is this a reasonable thing to do in the circumstance? And the law normally operates on the assumption that unless it's really shown to the contrary, an individual has the ability to take care of himself and is free, and other people shouldn't do things to him that he really doesn't want done. So the first thing I would want to know is, what is the risk of abuse of the law? Is there a risk of people who shouldn't be locked up being locked up?
I have personally been involuntarily hospitalized a number of times, including being brought to a court, declared insane, and put away. And as I recover from these episodic disorders, my thoughts are always the same, and that is, thank goodness somebody realized I was totally psychotic and took care of me and put me in here, because if I'd have been left out of there, I might not be here.
Right.
Eric Kendall, what gives us hope?
What gives us hope is that biology is capable of making enormous progress, that we've made progress in all other areas of medicine, really quite remarkable progress. And we face here the greatest challenge biology has ever faced, to understand the human mind and its most sophisticated, elaborate disorders. It's not an accident we don't know more about schizophrenia. This affects the most special, uniquely human cognitive functions that exist. So we ought to encourage people to do more science of the brain, but these are absolutely soluble problems.
For now, our story must end. Thank you for your insights and your incredible candor. Thank you, Carrie.
We've been talking about the treatment of mental illness in America in a Fred-friendly seminar. And if this has only appeared to muddy what you thought were your own clear opinions, then we've done our job. Again, in Fred Friendly's words, to make the agony of decision-making so intense that you can escape only by thinking. Thanks to all our participants, Justice Stephen Breyer, Dr. Art Kaplan, Pete Early, Dr. Frederick Fries, former State Senator Avil Gordley, Dr. Eric Kandel, Judge Stephen Lifeman, Estelle Richmond, Ellen Sachs, Dr. Tom Simpatico, Dr. Tracy Scale, Lauren Spiro, Susan Steffen, Dr. Sam Samberis, and our moderator, Frank Sesno. Funding for Minds on the Edge, Facing Mental Illness, is provided by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. Minds on the Edge was produced for radio and the web by Murray Street in collaboration with the Fred Friendly Seminars. Producers Lauren Krenzel and Stephen Rath. Audio recording by Bob Aldridge. Additional recordings by Robert Ald. Audio edit Craig Bray. Post-production by Chris Hurlis. The seminar was produced by Dominique Lesueur and written by Joan Greco. Executive producers are Richard Kilberg and Barbara Margolis. Find community organizations, legislative initiatives, and extended interviews, and comment or contribute your own experience at mindsontheedge.org. Thank you for listening to this Fred-friendly seminar. I'm Cokie Roberts.